Welcome back to Ride On. I am joined by Ian McKendrick, the founder and CEO of Faction. And as part of our lead up to Micromobility America this year, I wanted to interview some of the amazing companies that also won a Rider's Choice Award. So Ian and Faction won for Best Autonomy and Robotics Company for the Rider's Choice Award in 2023. And they'll be at Micromobility America talking about all the amazing things they've been up to since that win, of course. So with that, welcome, Ian, to the show.
Thanks, James. Really excited to be here today.
Cool. Awesome. Well, Ian, let's start with your journey, you know, in your background. I think it'd be great to understand, you know, what you're building is so futuristic, but also here in the present. I think a lot of people would love to understand, you know, your background and where you came from and how you started Faction.
Yeah, happy to share. If you look what I did in the past, it was primarily starting my career in consumer electronics. And it kind of set the tone for a lot of the projects I've worked on throughout my career. And it was really about building things that you could put into real people's hands. And I always love products that you can actually make a difference when you think about applying technology to people's lives. And I found my way to the vehicle space about several years ago. And it was really initially starting with commercial applications. So think, you know, closed course vehicle systems. And prior to starting Faction, I was VP of engineering at a company called Starsky Robotics, where we became one of the first companies to run completely driverless semi-trucks on public roads here in the United States. And this is with no safety drivers on board. They were completely driverless. And that was back in 2019. And basically, you know, when I started thinking about how you would apply these technologies to other applications, it led to Faction back in founding it in 2020, where we said, can we actually right-size vehicle systems and apply technology like driverless technology to the use cases that customers might be looking for, but at the same time, start to get us away from the car as a one-size-fits-all for everything? And that's why we got really excited about this category people are calling mini-mobility now, which is a little bit of a step up from micromobility, but still incredibly more efficient than what we do with automobiles and trucks for logistics, as well as even vehicle-on-demand use cases.
Gotcha. Okay. So background, of course, in consumer electronics, which is great. You know, thinking about building a company where people are, of course, touching your products in a way, but also so much intelligence, of course, inside of these products from a software perspective. I think for the audience, it would be great to define, of course, there's a lot of headlines now. We'll be talking a lot about this at Micromobility America, you know, how micromobility can work with autonomy, you know, with folks like Waymo and others, and of course, like yourselves. I think to start from a definition perspective, I'd be very curious. You talk about the idea of being driverless, and Faction is a, you know, you say you're a driverless company, not an autonomous company. Can you explain the difference between those two things just for viewers at home?
Yeah, it's a great question because autonomy has had a lot of hype over the last few years, and many of the companies spending, you know, billions of dollars to try to do a 100%, you know, AI-driven system are still very much active research projects. And so the way I kind of think about what we do at Faction is we're building driving robots that use a combination of autonomous technologies, but we also have humans in the loop known as teleoperators, and we call our system teleassist. So don't picture, you know, steering wheels and pedals for remote controlling a vehicle. That type of approach was great for parking lot demos, but it doesn't really scale on public roads. So we're a little bit more like air traffic control for the ground. So our vehicles generally know where they're going. They're always running on predefined routes. This is why we love, you know, business-to-business use cases because they're very repetitive. But every time a vehicle encounters an anomaly, there's always a human available to assist them, very much like an air traffic controller. And they press buttons to authorize behaviors. But this combination of technologies where you take very deterministic autonomy, where, you know, the vehicle's primary job is to stay in a lane and not hit things, and then you back it up with humans when necessary, allows you not only to do it very cost effectively, has a much lower requirement for the compute hardware that you have to put on the vehicles, but it's also very scalable. And you can do it now, not another 10 years from now, while you're stuck waiting for an AI breakthrough if you truly wanted a 100%, you know, self-driving type of solution. And that's really where I like to say that we're the more pragmatic approach to driverless systems. And I also like to say we pick unfair fights. We specifically look for the use cases that are the repetitive ones, because that's where we can have the biggest impact on our customers, which then pass those savings on to consumers as well as open up other use cases where I can either deliver something or bring you a vehicle, for example, that you might even be able to use yourself.
Gotcha. Okay. So I think that's a fair definition on driverless versus autonomy. It makes sense. You spoke to the B2B use case concept and repetitive trips. So I'd love to hear just some of the data. What are some of these repetitive trips? What do they look like? How, you know, what's the size of the market on them? Some examples would be great.
Yeah. So it's, when we started, actually, we began here in the Bay Area with a commercial bakery. And so if you've ever been down to Santana Row, there's a bakery down there called Cocola Bakery that right down there is in San Jose and Santana Row area. But Cocola's primary business is actually commercial bakery up in the Redwood City area on the peninsula here in the Bay Area. And they had tried to get by using gig worker services for trying to do their deliveries that were going out to coffee shops, restaurants, hotels, all the very repetitive kind of deliveries they would do every week. But what they found is a lot of times gig worker services are inconsistent. Sometimes they show, sometimes they don't. And if you're a commercial user, you really need a reliable logistics operation. And so they came to us and they said, it's less about the price point. It's more about just the consistency. And they also were telling us occasionally they would ship 50 cupcakes, let's say, to a coffee shop in the morning. And once in a while, one of those cupcakes would be missing. And so, you know, it's one thing if a gig worker gets into your or my fries, but when they get into a commercial shipment, they might reject the entire shipment due to product tampering. And so what we did starting back in 2022 is we completely replaced their use of some of the gig worker services by driving them in faction vehicles. And there was two things we wanted to do with this. One was to prove the business model. Could we actually do this for a commercial user, make it repetitive, map out the routes that we could run the driverless vehicles on, and then also prove that we were hitting the mileage targets to support a business model. And that business model was, you know, roughly trying to hit somewhere in that 3 to 5 mile sweet spot for these repetitive delivery loops. And it proved out very well. Like, not only were we hitting the economics, the customer was happy. In using our model of having a vehicle drive with human assistance on occasion, even if it had to pull over and ask for assistance once in a while, you know, croissants don't care. But if you had, you know, a human in the back, like people try to do with robotaxis, you'd get frustrated by pure robotic driving. And so our model is, I hate to say we dumb it down, but we dumb it down a little bit because our end customer doesn't necessarily care about us being the smartest guys in the room with, you know, bristling with LiDARs and AI driven vehicle. They care that we're going to move their cargo from point A to point B at the right price point. And so that's why I say we use targeted approaches with autonomy and then humans in the loop when necessary. And that achieves those objectives.
Yes. And then the cargo is not as opinionated. That's correct. Also a really good point. And I think definitely I would assume it would help with adoption. So that description of a kind of a commercial B2B use case there, 3 to 5 miles, how big is that market in the US? Like, what are you ultimately trying to eat into?
Wow. Yeah, so we're trying to, if you think of the global last mile logistics market, last mile logistics is actually the most expensive part of the supply chain. It's actually where most of the money goes into it. We've actually done a very good job optimizing for things like shipping or rail transport. You could even argue, I know this from my past experience doing driverless semi-trucks a few years ago, that even moving stuff by semi-truck on the highways is highly optimized. It's a low margin business. And you know, even though we're very excited about EV technology, sometimes diesel is actually the more cost effective and less impact when you're moving big payloads long distances. And so if you look at last mile, not only is it the highest cost center, but it's also the one where if you had to do repetitive deliveries, for example, this is where you start to eat into your margins very quickly. And so if you can attack last mile logistics by solving the driver shortage problem, driver wages are also a big part of that equation, as is fuel. By doing EV plus driverless, you're, you know, attacking more than 64% of where the cost is in your last mile supply chain. And so for us, last mile was important, and that market is over, you know, $380 billion globally for just last mile logistics. And in the US alone, even if you look at just the Southern United States and very attainable markets where you don't even have to get into, you know, snow and bad weather, everything else, this is a close to about a $35 billion market. So last mile is a great place to focus on. And that's kind of why we started there with the faction systems.
Okay. So let's talk about barriers then. So you clearly mentioned, hey, we don't have some of the barriers that you're going to have with fully autonomous. Clearly you're riding in the road. So you've mentioned before, you don't have the barriers at the city level. This is more just coming into state and federal regulation. But yeah, I'd be curious, what are your big, you know, 2023 now, we're seeing, for instance, the autonomy start to take off in certain cities, you know, some big wins here in California more recently. But yeah, sitting here in October of 2023, you know, as you as an entrepreneur, like what are the biggest obstacles in your way from, you know, taking on that, I can't remember the number exactly now, $80 or so billion market of last mile logistics that you think you could take on?
Yeah, so for us, I think, you know, regulatory is actually less of an issue in a lot of the states for the way we operate. If I roll the clock back to when I was at Starsky Robotics doing long-haul trucking, when we were running those driverless trucks for the first time in Florida back in 2019, there were no humans on board, no safety drivers. And that was completely legal based on legislation that had been introduced in the state of Florida. And, you know, even though you mentioned companies, you know, some of the larger names in the space, when we were still at startup phase and companies like Starsky, we co-sponsored a lot of the legislation that got introduced back in 2018 and 2019 to allow the mode of operation where you do autonomy plus humans in the loop. And so it was kind of an interesting time because I remember, I think it was in Georgia when they were passing their laws around driverless systems. The bill we were co-sponsoring, and I think even Waymo was a co-sponsor on that bill at the time, we were following one of the most contentious debates around an abortion bill that was coming out. It was split along party lines and, you know, people fighting left and right over it. And up comes the bill for driverless systems, and it passed with 99% approval rating because a lot of the states were looking to bring these technologies to market and finding ways to support it. California, we're a little funny. You know, we have a lot of tech in California, but we also have a lot of regulation in California. So you see California kind of bouncing back and forth on this. But legislation in states like Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Nevada, Arizona, a lot of the southern states even, which are fantastic places to roll out this technology because you've got weather on your side as well as market demand, they've actually already passed a lot of the laws that allow us to operate the way we currently operate. And in fact, with Nevada, we did our first operations in Nevada earlier this year. And it was, you know, working with the state of Nevada and their DMV to get, you know, the license plating, the permitting, everything. Very smooth process, very well thought out. But Nevada is also a state that's very lean forward on these technologies. And so you're seeing that in other places. So yeah, some of my favorite markets are in Nevada, Arizona, Texas, and Florida, which also happen to be, you know, great states to operate in just from a, you know, economic standpoint, as well as also market demand.
Okay. So sounds like you got plenty of room to grow right now where the barrier is not regulation and good markets. What would be the other barriers then? So why don't I, you know, how long before everything I need last mile logistic wise is a faction delivered, you know, package?
So one of the areas is actually one of the biggest, I think, impediments to scale right now is working with the appropriately motivated vehicle manufacturers that are thinking the same way that we are in terms of how do you scale fleets. One of the things that I always cringe a little bit every time you see another autonomous company demonstrating some level of autonomy on a production automobile that was not developed with the factory, you know that they are hacking that vehicle. They're essentially putting in control for steering or braking, that they're either injecting commands into the chassis, or they might be retrofitting some components. The problem with that is if there's a failure on that vehicle, it could be an uncontrolled vehicle rolling down the road because it doesn't have all the safety features built in from the factory. And this is everything like monitoring your steering, your braking, having sensors. So if you have a brake pressure loss in one of the lines, for example, that stuff has to be in throughout the entire chassis. If you're going to retrofit that, it gets very expensive very quick. And so you've seen that done with some of the big names in autonomy. But anybody who's at the smaller end of the spectrum, I see a lot of stuff that just makes me really nervous. So what we do at Faction is we always start by working directly with an OEM, original equipment manufacturer, who builds the vehicle to incorporate the Faction technology on the production line. This means that the vehicles that are coming off that line are drive-by-wire, which means a computer can control them essentially, enabled from the factory. And so one of our first partners here was Arcimoto. And the interesting thing about Arcimoto is those vehicles are technically regulated as motorcycles because they're an electric three-wheel auto cycle essentially in most states. But they're also highly modifiable compared to a traditional passenger car. And so when we put these types of technologies into light electrics and light mobility vehicles, it's much faster than trying to work with established or legacy automotive companies. Now, we are starting to see some new of the cars coming out. You know, Tesla's probably been one of the leaders here. You're seeing a lot of stuff happening now in China where the vehicles are designed from the beginning to be ready to accept these types of technologies. And that's one of the most important gates to being able to scale these vehicle systems. And so I'm very happy with the work that we've been doing with our current vehicle partners, but that's really what's going to gate the scaling of these types of systems in general. Because a lot of the big companies that build vehicles aren't willing to necessarily spend the money on driverless technologies unless the market's there. And the market's not quite there yet until you have enough fleet. And so it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem.
Okay, that makes sense. But it sounds like in general that what you're looking for is maybe some of the matrix is like you're looking for a newer company. The old guys move too slow and they don't really want to invest quickly here until the market's proven. It seems like you're looking for a pod form factor something under probably 1,000 kilograms or something, just from an efficiency perspective. So Arcimoto is in there. What are some other examples? I only say that, Arcimoto's had its struggles, trying to do other things, not doing what they're doing with you, but I think their consumer business is not quite panned out. Just curious what your other partners kind of look like in that arena and what you might be looking for in partners in that arena.
Yeah, excellent question, because I think it's interesting because when I first met the team at Arcimoto, my pitch to them was saying, hey, you've been selling these vehicles to early adopters as a second or third vehicle. If you really want to scale them, we need to make them fleet vehicles. And I think that's also, it's preaching to the choir a little bit with, people interested in new forms of mobility in general, because if you leave it up to individuals to buy a vehicle, Americans were some of the worst. We buy the largest vehicle with the most range and then we park it 90% of its life. I also like to joke that even if we go full electric, bringing you or I a pizza in a 4,000-pound electric vehicle with 300 miles of battery range, it's a little bit of overkill. And so these alternate formats make a ton of sense for fleet use and right-sizing the vehicles. And autonomy, if you can apply it appropriately to these vehicles, you get these interesting use cases. And so when I look at other vehicle partners, I'm usually looking EV. I'm then also looking at the size, which is, can we fit the vehicle to the mission? And to your point, there's a lot of stuff that can be done effectively with a vehicle that weighs less than 1,500 pounds or even less than 1,000 pounds. Any of the small payload deliveries, micro logistics, this is the area right now where we're still trying to use cars for these kind of applications with typically gig workers. It's horribly inefficient. It's not helping the gridlock situation. It's also not helping us from a, I would say, sustainability as well as a carbon footprint perspective, because most of the time that we're getting, let's say, a food delivery, it's happening in a 15-year-old vehicle that is typically internal combustion. And so it's not necessarily the best way to solve those problems. And if you move up a little bit into the larger payloads, we're also starting to see customers come out where they want, let's say store rebalancing or warehouse to store applications. And now, once again, if you can start to get them into vehicles that are smaller than the typical large vehicles they use, now they stop worrying a little bit less about full truckload. Can they dispatch things a little quicker? One of my favorite conversations I have with some of the big box retailers is they're so tired of getting beaten by Amazon when they realize they've got the same product that you and I might want literally 5 minutes from your house. And so if they could get it out to you more efficiently, or even rebalance something to a store where you can pick it up, it makes them much more competitive in the market. And so the applications are pretty broad, and a lot of it hinges on, can we hit the right price points and do it on demand, very cost effectively. And once you start checking the boxes of light vehicle, electric, driverless enabled, there's a lot of big possibilities.
So you've mentioned Arcimoto, of course that form factor being great. If there was other manufacturers out there, or if there are other manufacturers out there, who would they be? What are some names that people might know?
Yeah, Arcimoto, I think, the reason we started with them is because it was a shared mission. I think Arcimoto for many years had really been wanting to see us transform city centers and move to light mobility. So philosophically, we were very well aligned when we first met them. We've also publicly announced we're working with Tello Trucks. And so Tello is building this lightweight truck platform, more like the urban activity vehicle, the way they kind of frame it, where you've got a vehicle that's the footprint of a Mini Cooper, but has the payload space of something like a Ford F-150 in the back. If you're familiar with the K cars in Japan, where these like little tiny vehicles, but they, are extremely space efficient. It's almost like the American K car. And so it almost brackets our partners right now, where we have, you know, things like Arcimoto on the small scale, but then you've got the slightly step up form factor with vehicles like Tello that will be out in the next couple of years. But we look for things like that. You've used the frame, the term pod cars or pod vehicles. That kind of format is a fun one because the pod can be anything, whether it's cargo or maybe it's one of the vehicles where you can bring it to somebody and they get to drive it themselves. We were working with Electromechanica on the Solo platform until they recently pivoted, which was a shame too, because I really love the Solo. The Faction team put thousands of miles on the Solo fleet that we had for the vehicle on demand use case development we were doing. And if you're driving around a single occupant, three-wheel system in the carpool lane while paying zero tolls, you feel like one of the smartest people on the road. So it's one of those things where it's not a question of if this will be a category, it's when. And we look at some of the technologies that we build as an enabler to get it into people's hands faster. Because if you leave it just to us to buy that as a second or third vehicle, it goes slower. You'll get the early adopters. But if you can hit a button and bring one of those vehicles to you, that's how we really get it in the hands of a lot of people faster.
Yeah. Okay. So I think one, the capacity argument is so fascinating as you think about, okay, actually you can take out the driver cockpit concept and the amount of space that's saved to potentially bring the overall sizes down or just make them more efficient on the way up. Let's make the safety argument. So I think I read a stat that at least in London, and I assume this is fairly universal, you might have better data than me on this. I think it was something like 18% of all pedestrian and bicycle deaths occurred from delivery trucks, basically, which is, that's one out of every five, which is, that's very high. And of course, it's crazy to think that's just, that's just things that are delivering goods. And of course, it's very dangerous. It changes, of course, the life of the person that was killed, changes the person that was the driver that, that tragic fatality happened, was the cause of that. Do you how important is that? Is that a big part of what people are looking for? Why do we make it acceptable that, one out of every five deaths maybe comes from a delivery truck? And, we're trying to figure out faster how to change this. I'm just curious on what you think is happening there and how we can change that.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting topic because I wasn't familiar with the statistic on the delivery trucks, but I can believe it because it's relative size. Having us, walk around or bike around. I'm also a motorcyclist, so ride your motorcycle around really large format vehicles means that you always lose if there's an impact. And I think with the delivery trucks, having those in city centers is definitely problematic. It creates parking hazards. It creates the traffic issues. And to your point, also creates a chance for really injuring people because you have these large format vehicles around. So I like the idea of going to smaller vehicles in general. But as I mentioned, being a motorcyclist, you're very conscious about wearing a helmet, safety equipment, airbag jackets were even a new invention over the last few years. But you can't convince everybody in the general population to put on all that kind of equipment and a helmet. It's going to not be, convenient enough for them. And this is the same reason why cyclists are really, passionate about being able to get around city centers on their bikes, but not everybody can ride a bike. And then there is a little bit of that dirty little secret in this electric scooter space, so like kind of the kick scooters and the stand-on scooters, where they also have a very high injury rate. Because people are riding them on sidewalks or they're not using helmets. And so you got to try to have to find this happy medium. It's not quite scooters, bikes, and motorcycles. It's definitely not, full-size vehicles for one size fits all, but it's this kind of vehicle format in between. And what I've seen is that, when you're thinking mini mobility vehicles, single occupant or two-seater kind of vehicles, in the cities, people tend to not worry too much about it because the speeds are slower. Highways, people will get a little bit nervous. As a motorcyclist, I feel actually pretty safe in them. But on the highways, that's where people start to think that, even riding something like an Arcimoto or a Solo feels a little strange to them because you're a small vehicle at high speed. But in the urban centers, it makes a ton of sense to go smaller. And I think the one thing I can add just from my personal experience is we've seen some of the crash data on these vehicles. And if you talk to the manufacturers, a lot of due care went into making these small vehicles extremely safe. Something like an Arcimoto, you're basically riding inside a roll cage, essentially. And they've had incidents where, you know, people got T-boned by big vehicles and they walked away just fine. Same thing when the Solo vehicles, they had a very robust safety cage in that vehicle that was essentially riding inside of a motorcycle helmet, if you think of it that way. And unlike something like an SUV, if you're to roll over one of these other vehicles, they all meet the same rollover requirements, but they actually hold up better than some of the passenger cars and SUVs that have to face, you know, having roofs collapse on them too. So I think designed properly, mini mobility vehicles and light vehicles can be just as safe as what we're used to in passenger cars. At the same time, since they weigh a lot less, it's alleviating the problem you brought up where we have large format, you know, in these dense urban areas.
Yeah, that makes sense. In terms of, you know, we've recently had on like Laura Kavanaugh, the fire commissioner in New York, you know, where they're battling a tremendous amount of battery fires in mostly in apartment buildings. And this is mostly coming from, you know, do-it-yourself kits converting acoustic bikes to electric bikes. And their big message is actually trying to get out to somewhere between 65,000 to 100,000 delivery workers that live in and around New York City, and of course work for in the gig economy. And you know, have you talked to New York at all? Have you talked to urban centers at all about your solution as a potential solution up against, of course, what seems like a not exponentially growing problem, but a massively growing problem that's not only lighting buildings on fire, but also people are dying in these battery fire buildings. Has there been any talks there? Anything you've come to with any cities specifically?
We haven't had specific conversations about the safety of the vehicle systems. I think we tend to focus more on the use cases to begin with. We are, you know, aware that, you know, if people are doing, you know, their own EV conversions, there is a certain level of risk there because a lot of times those components are not, you know, what would you say, blessed by a factory that built it and did all the safety homologation testing on it, on those vehicles. They, you know, the do-it-yourself stuff sometimes either scavenges parts or puts systems together that were not necessarily fully designed to work together. What we've seen though is that if you work with an OEM that is taking due care on a lot of the electrical systems, and they also work with us so that we know that we're going to add an additional electrical load for computers and other systems that we put on, if you design it properly, the vehicles are very safe. Battery technology in general is a well-known, you know, quantity, but it's just that if you are not using it within its specs or its parameters, that's when you start to run into trouble. And so I think one of the more important aspects of doing an electric vehicle properly is you have a very robust battery management system on those vehicles that knows everything you're plugging into that battery, all the current you're pulling from it, how you're charging that battery. And the manufacturers that take this very seriously, I think, build extremely safe electric vehicle systems. And so that's why I wouldn't want to commingle them a little bit with some of the you know, do-it-yourself.
No, why? I mean, why not go to the city and say, hey, why? You know, again, this is a massive problem for them. They've got to figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's talks of course, apartment buildings not allowing e-bikes into them. So, like, literally saying, you know, you can't have an electric battery inside of your apartment for insurance reasons. The city has a, you know, New York is one of many cities, but why not go to the cities and lobby, like, you know, for every 10, you know, workers on an illegal e-bike, we could have one faction vehicle doing all that work. Like, is there opportunities like that, BD development, business development like that, where you're just going directly to the city and saying, hey, we can take on 100,000 of your daily orders, which might be 15% or, you know, whatever it might be. And that seems like a reasonable business case to me.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it's an interesting way to position it because I think I want to promote what we do is, you know, safe, reliable, and consistent for how we operate. I also don't want to throw too many stones at some of the other formats because I think there's also a really great place for bicycle messengers and people who can kind of do that quick on-demand stuff as well. You mentioned the UK, for example, trucks. I love the fact that they've got motorcycle, you know, delivery couriers and things. They've done a lot better than we have, I think, in North America in terms of mixed mode transportation and parts of Europe too. So I almost wouldn't want to start with the negative aspect, but I would also want to talk about how do you make it even better. And for things where you are concerned about, you know, too much congestion, let's say on sidewalks with too many bikes, or the e-bike conversions are, you know, potentially risky. I would want to see maybe a little bit of positive regulation around what types of vehicles could be used for these applications. And even though I think a lot of companies, you know, you hear regulation and they're like, oh, regulation, government's getting involved. I think doing consistent regulation for these types of vehicle systems and doing also common sense regulation makes a lot of sense. And so even in my category where we're doing driverless systems, I welcome government regulation and certification of driverless technologies. Because you've seen a lot of situations where people are trying to push the limits a little bit, whether that's that startup trying to get their next round of funding, or even some of the bigger companies trying to justify their rollouts. It wasn't always supervised the way it should have been by some of the regulators because they didn't have the tools and they didn't have enough understanding yet either. And so I think with these, you know, examples like you're talking about for battery systems, if those e-bikes are held to a higher standard, and to get a permit to be a, let's say, a courier or a delivery service, you have to be using an approved system. That I look at it as positive regulation. It's not necessarily punitive. You're not saying you're not taking it away, but you're saying if you're going to do this, do it right. And the same thing applies to even what we do.
Yeah. So let's play this out. So like one of our thesis is that basically the regulators are going to start to come down on the delivery companies. They're not going to go after the individuals. And they're going to say to the delivery companies, if one of your workers was responsible for a fire, you're responsible, which is going to create, you know, this is very similar to, like, let's just take Uber. You know, you can't drive a vehicle without the license, right? The driver has to go through a certification process. It's very clear, cut and dry. Uber is responsible for that driver. In the case of e-bike delivery workers, they're not responsible today, right? Like the way it works, there's no certification. There's no, hey, is this bike UL certified or any of that. This is going to increase the costs on, for what we saw Instacart go public, DoorDash, Uber Eats, et cetera. Their costs we believe are going to go up quite a bit. I don't think they're ready for this. I don't think this has been managed with Wall Street as an example. Do you talk to them at all about this and what's going to come and how this is coming and potentially other types of solutions? I'm just curious if you see, you know, cities as an angle from just a strict regulatory, they have to be, you know, faction certified vehicles necessarily. But how about from these last mile solutions and what those conversations look like?
Yeah, it's a fun topic because I think, you know, we're a little small still right now at Faction, so we don't have necessarily all of the, you know, government relations and regulatory personnel on staff to be able to do our own lobbying and our own kind of programs for this. So we participate and we actually will, provide input to some of these processes when we have the opportunities. I used to do a little bit more of it when I was doing the driverless semi-trucks because we were getting ready to launch that point in time. And so we did a lot of work with government agencies and, you know, especially like I'll use the state of Florida as an example. Before we ran the first trucks in those states, there was tons of closed course testing that was going on their roads and highways in cooperation with the state. And then we also met with both, you know, police as well as, you know, road and DOT kind of representatives to make sure they knew exactly what we were doing. And so they had full access to our test plans. They knew exactly how we're going to operate. And you really want to be a partner with government when you're doing these new technologies. You don't want to try to do an end run around them. That's a very quick recipe to get yourself banned at some point or get regulated out of certain markets when they start to change things. But what you want to do is you want to come up with ways in which, you know, regulators can say, these are the rails that you play within, because this is just safe best practices for how they operate. You mentioned, you know, UL ratings on e-bikes. I think that's a very important part of it. I would also like to see those same kind of ratings on battery packs in electric vehicles. It'll give not only, you know, manufacturers guidelines to follow, but it also means that consumers have a certain level of confidence in those systems. And it's not something that I think has to go as heavy-handed as some of the things you might see, like something like aviation, but it has to be close to what we see in automotive eventually. And automotive is probably maybe a little overregulated in some areas. And that's why some of us like light mobility, because you can move a little bit quicker. But at the same time, we're not looking to shirk our responsibilities as either manufacturers or technology providers. The goal is to build reliable, safe businesses with new technology in a way that's going to be accepted by consumers, and not, you know, running these problems where you're going to be irritating your, you know, state and local officials. And so you want to do this in a cooperative way. And some states are better than others. Some cities are better than others. And as a small company, you know, we may have a little bit of a voice in it, but we're trying to draft behind a few of the bigger companies right now. But I would say overall, philosophically, just for myself and also for Faction, we welcome it because it will standardize the way in which we build and deploy systems. And I think it's good overall that as regulators get a little bit more educated, putting some common sense regulation in place always makes sense.
Yeah. And so I think your timing is just exceptional in that, you know, just to take not to belabor this, but, you know, New York has a real problem on their hands. They've now put out UL certification. They're trying to strip any bike that's not UL certified off the streets. They run a program, for instance, with the Equitable Commute Project, which was you can turn in your basically your DIY kit for a new vehicle. New York Times just covered it. It covered it last month and had three delivery workers do that, you know, out of potentially 100,000, right? So that regulation did not work, or the concept of like, hey, let's just see if they'll upgrade to a much more expensive vehicle is not working. The economic model does not work out for those gig workers. So I think there's a harsh reality and awakening for governments and for, again, these very big delivery companies that, like, there's probably a lot more investment that needs to go into this space, and there needs to be a different type of player. So with that, you've said it a couple of times, Ian, you're a small company, you're a startup, but clearly I think your ambition is to not be a small company for a long time. My guess is you need capital all the time, and, you know, to ultimately win, you're going to need a lot of capital. Anything in that space we should know about? I know you come from Y Combinator, which is great. You know, so many successful companies come out of Y Combinator. But yeah, what's the latest with the fundraising and where you want to take it?
Yeah, so it's one of these topics that as a startup company, you're always raising money. And, you know, it gets compounded when you look at what we're doing, because we fall in this category people call hard tech or deep tech. And usually that's a euphemism for you're combining hardware, software, services. We throw in AI. You're working with OEMs. There's just a lot of moving pieces. And through most of my career, when I was doing even consumer electronics, I always loved building products that combined things like hardware, software, and services, because they're more defensible products, but it's also a bigger challenge. And that challenge is kind of a fun one to deliver on a complete solution. And so that's what we do at Faction. We don't just build a piece of the technology. We're building a solution. And to do that means that your initial capital goes into a lot of development up front. We had to build prototypes. We had to build OEM relationships with vehicle manufacturers. We had to build a fleet management system in the cloud with TeleAssist. We had to build pieces of the technology that lives on the vehicles for safety architecture and, you know, driverless tech. So, you know, it's an ambitious project. And so that's why, you know, when we went through Y Combinator, we actually already had working prototypes before we went into YC. And we had a successful initial raise in 2021, where we raised a little over $6 million to do our initial phase for the company. I can tell this to any entrepreneur right now who's listening, and they probably already know it. Raising money in 2022 and 2023 has been extremely difficult for most companies. And so when we looked at our fundraising for, you know, last year and this year, we said, you know, it's probably not a good time to raise a Series A, but we will need more capital to continue on our mission. And so we, like most startups who were planning ahead last year, we did austerity measures and made sure we were spending very efficiently. But thankfully we have some very supportive investors, and we have a seed extension round that we actually just completed our first close on last month. That was led by one of our existing investors, which was TDK Ventures. We haven't actually announced all the details on that yet, so it's coming soon, and there will be a press release on it. But this gave us the capital to continue doing what we were doing with some of the new customers that are coming out for 2024 programs. And you're going to see us start to do some work with some of the larger national retail brands, as well as some of the national food brands that will be coming out next year. And we're super excited about this because we love our early adopter customers that allowed us to prove our models and show that how the system would work. But the big step up for us as a company is how do you then start to scale these fleets instead of, you know, tens of vehicles, get the thousands, right? Yeah. That's kind of really the next evolution for us.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, just to conclude here, Ian, I want to applaud you on just your capital efficiencies. I think the idea of what you're building and how you built it, right? Like you said, soft tech, hard tech, deep tech, you are surrounding what, you know, if I were to close my eyes and say, well, how much money does this company need to raise? I would think, you know, several hundred millions of dollars. And you've done what you've been able to do to date with, you know, a 6 million seed and now this follow on, which is just incredible. So I think, you know, a lot goes out to you and your team in terms of just a benchmark for capital efficiency, something we, of course, didn't see the last 4 or 5 years in our market and a lot of markets. So congratulations to you and your team on that. Congratulations, as I mentioned at the beginning, on your Writer's Choice Award. I'm very excited to see how you do when we roll it out again, of course, for next year. And can't wait to see you at Micromobility America, and for everyone that is able to attend, of course, being able to see some of your technology at play around will be super fun. And to have you on stage as well with some announcements will be great as well. So Ian, thank you so much for joining us today, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Of course. Thanks, James. Really excited to be here and looking forward to Micromobility this year. We're going to be able to share some of our progress and have vehicles out there for display again. And so Micromobility has been a great organization to be affiliated with. And I think just the support, not only for the smaller formats, but also as mini formats that we're doing with Faction as well. Altogether, all of us are going to have a massive impact on the mobility space over the next couple decades. And it's just fun to be part of it.
Awesome. Right on. Thanks so much.
Take care.